You are listening to the War on the Rocks podcast on strategy, defense, and foreign affairs. My name is Ryan Evans. I'm the editor-in-chief of War on the Rocks. In this episode, we talk about counterterrorism from the Bush administration to the Obama administration to the Trump administration. Two great guests for this episode. We have Colin Call, now an associate professor in the Security Studies program at the Georgetown School of Foreign Service. He also most recently served as Vice President Biden's National Security Advisor, and earlier in the Obama administration was the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Middle East. We also had Stephen Tankel. Stephen is an assistant professor in the School of International Service at American University, an adjunct senior fellow at the Center for New American Security, and a senior editor at War on the Rocks, most importantly. He previously served as senior advisor for Asian Pacific Security Affairs at the Department of Defense. He has a new book coming out later this year that I highly recommend, With Us and Against Us, America's Partners in the War on Terror. In the middle of the episode, I also preview the new War on the Rocks membership, which we launched this week. Happy listening. So, Colin, let's go backwards to, what, January, February 2009. You had just entered the Obama administration as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Middle East, and you're sort of surveying your portfolio. And from a counterterrorism perspective, what did you see the way the Bush administration had been doing things? And then what were the plans, at least at the very beginning of the administration, to change the way you do business on counterterrorism?
The president had kind of a number of objectives right out of the gate. Obama did. One was to narrow the scope of the so-called war on terror. That is to make it narrowly focused on al-Qaeda and its affiliates, as opposed to lumping al-Qaeda in with a number of other terrorist organizations, ranging from Hamas to the FARC, et cetera. So there was a narrowing of the scope. The other really was a resource issue. I think that clearly Obama was hoping to shift resources from Iraq, which he always portrayed as kind of peripheral to the global campaign against al-Qaeda, to Afghanistan, and that required drawing down resources from Iraq. But I think more broadly, as he looked across the region, he was much more attracted to what eventually became known as the small footprint or West Point model of not having tens of thousands of boots on the ground conducting counterinsurgency, but handing off more responsibility to partners and relying more on high-tech assets like drones and airstrikes and limited numbers of special operations forces on the ground. So that was obviously a model he went to over time. But you remember, he inherited 144,000 troops in Iraq, 300 bases, 3 million pieces of equipment. So task number one was to start drawing that stuff down.
And Stephen, what were you doing in early 2009?
I was doing my PhD, Ryan.
Yeah. But what were you doing your PhD on?
So my PhD was actually on how jihadist groups that were extant but independent from al-Qaeda at the time of 9/11 evolved after 9/11, and why some adopted its more global focus and others didn't. And at the time, the idea was to sort of try to show that we shouldn't be lumping all of these actors together from an academic perspective, that they were products of their own environments, that they were in many ways, not a one-size-fits-all jihadist. So sort of the, academically inclined version of that scoping that Colin's talking about. By the time I finished my PhD, right, that is pretty well accepted, although now, maybe I need to dust that off. But that's since informed a lot of the work that I've done on actually how we cooperate with our counterterrorism partners around the world.
So if you could give us a bit on how the Bush administration approached that, working by, with, and through partners.
Sure. I think it's helpful to start with the recollection that when the Bush administration comes into office, counterterrorism is not a major focus, and it becomes the driving force behind its foreign policy. So a lot of the scoping and the resource issues that Colin is talking about, to my mind, is Obama trying not just to scope things more narrowly, but really also to situate counterterrorism within a more balanced security paradigm for the United States. The Bush administration, right, because CT is the driving force behind its foreign policy, it is really looking for partners to help at the end of the day with capturing and killing. That's the first 4 years. There's this the 2003 counterterrorism policy on paper looks really, really holistic. And in reality, it is, are you going to help us find and capture or kill the guys that we're interested in getting after?
Can we just pause a moment as the drinks are arriving here at Bukert Saloon where we're recording in Eastern Market? Looks great. Cheers, gentlemen.
Cheers.
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 So you're saying on paper, the 2003 Bush strategy?
On paper, the 2003 Bush strategy is quite holistic and comprehensive. But in practice, what the Bush administration is essentially doing is a very militaristic approach, and it is looking for either doing its heavy footprint invasion in Iraq, or it's looking for partners to act as proxies, and that can be Pakistani forces or Yemeni forces going out and capturing and killing al-Qaeda, or it can be working through non-state proxies, warlords in Afghanistan, warlords in Somalia, to do more of the same. And, you know, that is a lot of how, you know, I see the Bush administration looking at these partnerships early on. I think the other important point to make is that, you know, Bush has that rhetoric of you're with us or you're with the terrorists. But in reality, you know, we work with a lot of countries that are simultaneously with us and with the terrorists in one way or another. So we talk that talk, but we don't necessarily walk that walk.
Yeah, I think I think Stephen's points are really important, because Obama frames so much of his overall position on counterterrorism as a response to the Bush administration and to correct a series of imbalances that he saw across the board on foreign policy, but that were most manifest in the greater Middle East, stretching from North Africa up through Afghanistan and Pakistan. And there are actually two other things that I didn't mention a minute ago that I think are relevant here. I think one is a real desire, a belief by Obama that it would be possible to make progress in the campaign against terrorism by resetting relations with the Islamic world. And you see a real effort to do that, first with the Nowruz speech to the Iranians and then with the Cairo speech in the summer of 2009. Now, obviously, that's an agenda that has imperfect success. We'll get to that. But I think the other thing that he really tried to do over time was to the degree that we were going to rely on the kinetic piece of counterterrorism to really put a legal structure around it or a set of procedures, not so much outside the executive branch, but a set of decision-making procedures within the executive branch, because I think he quickly realized that things like drones and the kinds of intelligence we were able to pick up and map out networks and basically identify individuals who might be threats and kill them at long distance with low cost to us was an extraordinarily seductive toolkit. And that if it wasn't disciplined and if you didn't put limiting principles on it in some way, we'd go into a very dark place. So that's another thing he struggles with throughout the presidency.
Just to get at the drones issue, and then, Stephen, I want to talk to you about difficult partners, particularly Pakistan after. But when the Obama administration, when you guys were coming into office, drones had been used by the Bush administration, but certainly not on the sort of industrial scale that they're used today. Was there any understanding in the early Obama administration, 2009, what the potential was for the combination of these different technologies and capabilities? Like, if I could tell 2009 Colin Call, like, where we've gotten with drones.
I mean, I think there was a kind of almost dialectic back and forth between policymakers and evolutions in technology. And the reality is some of the reasons why the Obama administration relied more on drones is because our technology, we had more of them. They were better. They flew longer. And the intelligence apparatus around them was getting better and better. Our ability to map networks, our ability to use big data, our ability to generate targets was going up. So he inherited, I think, you know, a set of counterterrorism technologies that were still on the upswing. He then, in narrowing the scope to a particular network, it focused almost all of the intelligence community's resources on identifying targets within that network. And so you start to get a extraordinarily surgical but brutally efficient campaign to go after al-Qaeda core in the border region between Afghanistan and Pakistan. And then you are also seeing a growing, an ever-escalating campaign against Al-Qaeda's second most important affiliate, which was its branch in Yemen, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. And so this, remember, this is pre-Arab Spring we're talking about here. So Ali Abdullah Saleh is still the president of Yemen. And we have a strategy that basically combines having the central command work with Yemeni forces to build up their special operations forces and some of their other capabilities, and then partnering with our intelligence and military assets to start going out and killing AQAP at an ever-increasing rate. And you see, as these bomb threats and other threats start to come out of AQAP threat streams, that the pace of that really picks up.
Some might also say more cynically that you also don't have to put dead terrorists in Guantanamo Bay. Was that an overt or clear motivator for such an ambitious drone targeted killing campaign?
So I certainly never heard it articulated that way. I think that there was a clear desire to close Guantanamo. I think the president hoped to accomplish that within his first year in office. It obviously proved untenable, largely because Congress wouldn't work with us to relocate a small subset of the folks who would never be relocated back to the United States. But it was a standard across time that, as we considered whether to take a strike against a high value target, one of the questions that was asked around the policymaking table in the sit room was it possible to capture this person? And more often than not, the answer was no. Now you can raise the question: well, if we had lots of boots on the ground, we had detention centers, and we set up other things, you could maybe create the conditions at high cost and high risk to be able to capture folks, interrogate them, etc. But the reality was, when you rely on this indirect approach, largely by remote control, the opportunity, and you're not willing to put a lot of boots on the ground to run risk to capture folks. Most of the time, the answer came back: no, there isn't a viable option to capture this person.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to add, I think, especially from a partner-centric perspective, it's helpful to remember that by this time, the places where we're doing the majority of our drone strikes are places where we are trying to work with and through our partners, but our partners are very often unwilling or unable to do the kinds of things that we want them to do. So a big part of the Obama counterterrorism approach that people have talked about is building partner capacity, but you can try to build partner capacity. If you're not able to actually get those partners on the ground to capture people, then you are left with, as Colin said, either putting your own people on the ground to do it and create conditions for that, or to rely on drone strikes. And so I saw drone strikes and the intelligence apparatus that is built to support it as sort of evidence of the ways in which, by the time Obama is coming into office, I think even more broadly, the U.S. counterterrorism community is consolidating around aspects of partnerships where they work and trying to work around partners where they don't work.
Building partner capacity is sort of one of those Washington buzzwords. What does that mean in practice? When you're building partner capacity, what are you doing specifically?
So, you know, the term, as far as I'm familiar with it, really starts coming...
You better be familiar with it, given the subject of your next book, which we'll get to later.
Comes out of this idea that we're going to build the Iraqi forces and then the Afghan forces so that, you know, as we stand down, they can stand up. And that is then parlayed into a broader effort to build partner forces in different countries. And this is both about, you know, in some cases, building numbers. In other cases, it's about equipping them with greater capabilities so that they can find, fix, and finish the people that we want them to. There is, I would argue, an overwhelmingly military-centric focus at the expense of other aspects of counterterrorism, although I do think the Obama administration tries to get at that somewhat in terms of doing also security sector reform, building the capacity of a country's judicial system to actually put people in jail, prison capacity to hold them, intelligence capacity, things like that. That takes a lot longer, and it's much more difficult in part because, you know, we can't order nearly as many, you know, or we don't have as many people here who can go over and do training for law enforcement or prosecutorial capacity or things like that as we do special forces that we could send in to do military partner capacity building.
Could you, so this brings us to the subject of your next book. What's the basic argument? Maybe you could use two of your case studies to sort of illustrate, make one of them Pakistan.
Sure. The book essentially asks the question, if we're going to work with and through our partners, what can we expect from them? And the overwhelming argument is that most of our partners, especially in the Middle East, Africa, South Asia, the places where jihadists operate, are going to enable us in some areas and constrain us in others. They are with us and they are against us. And I would argue that, you know, in terms of, you know, and Pakistan is very illustrative of this. It is the quintessential frenemy partner for us. And what I would say is that when their threat perceptions argue in favor of going after terrorists on the ground and dismantling their infrastructures, they will do it. But absent that, there's very little that we're going to be able to do in the ways of offering security assistance or using coercion or using soft power to get them to move off the dime.
Even throwing buckets of money at them.
Even throwing buckets of money at them. And we've seen that with Pakistan, that money cannot buy, you know, a change in a strategic calculus. And in some ways, you could argue that with Yemen, you know, what they wanted to do was they wanted to go after AQAP just enough to keep us giving them money, but not actually destroy AQAP, because then that money's going to drop. And I honestly, I would lay that in part at you know, at Saleh's feet, and also in part at the Bush administration's feet for sort of turning their back on Yemen a little bit in 2005, 2006. The one other thing I would say here is where throwing buckets of money can help, where our relationship can help, is in things like access, things like intelligence cooperation, a lot of those other areas that are really the nuts and bolts of counterterrorism.
What are those things that drive the way a state looks? Let's say, you know, states dealing with, there's a terrorist group that the United States doesn't like that is working some in some ways from the territory of a given state. We go to them and say, these are bad guys, we need you to help us get them. Explain why they might just look at that problem differently.
We tend to think about it as, do we share a threat with another country? And I would argue that it's not enough to share a threat with another country. It's how are they going to prioritize that threat relative to other threats?
And local politics.
And does that threat have utility for them as well, right? So everybody shares the ISIS threat. ISIS is everybody's major threat. But Turkey, as you are going to know better than I am, right, is more concerned about other threats. Saudi Arabia is more concerned about Iran than it necessarily is about ISIS. A lot of countries have other threats that they're more concerned about than they are about ISIS. And so that's going to be a big driving factor is this group a direct threat to me? Is it a bigger threat to me than other threats? And sometimes it's going to be the case that by going after a group, even if it is a threat, you can make other threats worse.
Colin, based on your experience as DASD and then later working for the vice president, how did you see this play out in real time? You think this holds water?
Yeah, no, I think Stephen is exactly right. Look, the building,
Stephen loves hearing that.
My favorite thing to hear.
The building partnership capacity model starts in the second term of the Bush administration. In fact, I spent a year and a half in the Stability Operations Office during the Rumsfeld era in 2005-2006 through a Council on Foreign Relations Fellowship. And it was an interesting office because it was kind of this liberal backwater in Rumsfeld's Pentagon. Remember, Rumsfeld didn't want to do stability operations and all of the rest. And we used to joke that the 24 of us in the office did stability operations while the other 24,000 people in Rumsfeld's building did instability operations. But in any case, I think that the impetus for building partnership capacity, especially from, you know, 2006 onward, is a recognition not only of the difficulties we're having in Iraq and Afghanistan, but I think a dawning that the model for Iraq and Afghanistan is simply not a sustainable model anywhere else. That, you know, we have 150 to 200,000 forces in the field in any given day. The army is running out of schlitz. The surge just accelerates that. So I think there's a real recognition that we have to be able to use security assistance, security cooperation, partnerships, especially through our special operations community and security sector reform, to try to build up partners. But there are a number of issues here. First is just a capacity issue. There are a lot of places where there's literally no capacity because you're dealing in an ungoverned space or failed state scenario. The state may not exist, or the state may actually be antagonistic. So in today's Syria, for example, there is a capable Syrian state, but they're not willing or able to go after ISIS. So you have to look for actors outside of the state. It's more of an unconventional warfare model as opposed to a traditional FID, foreign internal defense type of model. In other places, there are nascent partners and host nation governments that you can work with, but you have to build up their basic capabilities. A lot of times, both our intelligence community and our special operations community focuses on building up an elite subset of their military to focus on counterterrorism. A lot of times CIA works with one entity, the soft community works with another entity. Sometimes those entities integrate, sometimes they compete with one another. But the idea being that even if the overall military is not terribly capable, you can identify a subset of a professional cadre that you can turn into stone cold killers to work with you to go after the bad guys. And that's where that's what we try to do in places like successfully we did in places like Iraq with the standing up of the counterterrorism services, Afghanistan with special operations community there, and in Yemen we also try to replicate that. We also try to get them, you know, more guns, more sniper rifles, more anti-tank systems, more helicopters so that they can get around the country, more Coast Guard ships so that they can police their maritime domain, those type of basic capacities. But the last issue is what Stephen pointed to as it relates to the political will. And I could not agree more that part of the problem is whether they're willing to do it at all, but really the bigger issue is where they rank it in their issue of priorities. So for Ali Abdullah Saleh, his regime survival and his competition with the Houthis was always a bigger priority for him, and his competition with Southern secessionists than AQAP. So AQAP was useful for him to have a kind of gravy train of American money and arms, and he would do operations that we pushed him to do and approve, but it was never his top priority. He always put the Houthis and the Southern secessionists and his overall regime stability higher. I mean, people think of Saleh now as an ally of the Houthis, but for most of his tenure, the Houthis were his mortal enemy. Likewise, I agree with Stephen that the biggest challenge we've had in the counter-ISIS campaign in Syria has been the fact that the Saudis and other Gulf states have prioritized Iran over ISIS, and that has contributed to their tolerance for hardline Islamist groups that can lean towards the extremist variety. And on the Turkish side, is that they prioritized for a long time Assad over ISIS and currently prioritize the Kurds over ISIS. And so even when you can identify capable partners like the Turks, who are the most powerful military in that part of the world, their priorities may not be the same. And that creates all sorts of challenges for the indirect approach.
Let's take a quick break from that interview to talk about a big new feature, the War on the Rocks membership, which launches this week. This membership program, available for a low monthly fee, provides access to two services. First up, we have the Warcasts, weekly webcasts featuring me and a rotating panel of three experts telling you what you need to know about international security. If you tune in live, you can ask questions of our experts, or you can watch or listen later. The second members-only service is the War Hall, a closed discussion forum where you can interact directly with our writers and each other, take part in our members-only book club, and keep your finger on the pulse of the national security community. Check out why you should become a member at warontherocks.com/subscribe. Now back to our regularly scheduled programming. I'd like to talk about a sort of larger thematic issue, and that's it's a delicate one. It's one of terminology and religion. And these are things that Bush and then Obama and now Trump have approached in very different ways. Bush was very careful to make clear to the American people from very shortly after the 9/11 attacks, maybe even the next day, I forget, that Islam was not the enemy. He had Islamic leaders standing over his shoulders when he said that, along with other faith leaders. His administration also used words like Islamism freely, jihadism freely, to describe the threat.
Islamofascism as well.
Well, yeah, I think Christopher Hitchens used that one for a while, and then the administration adopted it for a little bit.
That was an unfortunate hiccup.
Well, whatever was unfortunate or not, it was certainly entertaining. But the Obama administration came in, and it seemed to very quietly just ban the use of all these terms. Anything that might draw a connection between the fact that these groups believe themselves to be drawing inspiration from Islam was either ignored or dismissed as saying it's not to do with Islam, it's a complete distortion. Which I think he eventually saw pushback on, not just from the right, which you'd expect, but also from, you know, I would say some voices from the center left. There was that big article that came out in The Atlantic about a year ago by Graham Wood that talked about ISIS and its Islamic inspirations. We'll get into what Trump does in a minute, because that's an interesting conversation, but maybe you two could sort of shed light on that shift and what you each think about it.
Well, I think part of this goes to a belief that Obama had that anything that seemed to suggest a clash of civilizations created a self-fulfilling prophecy, and that he was going to err on the side of not putting the word Islam next to extremism, not because he didn't believe that there weren't bastardizations of Islamist ideology that fed Salafist jihadi groups like Al-Qaeda and eventually the Islamic State or groups like Boko Haram, etc., but because he thought that rhetorically it gave them a win. And so part of his narrowing was our enemy are transnational groups that threaten our homeland and our interests around the world, principally Al-Qaeda and its affiliates. So we're going to call them Al-Qaeda. And we're going to call the broader challenge violent extremism. And we're not going to connect Islam to it, not out of some sense of political correctness, but because of a theory of the case, which may be right or wrong, that in doing so, you actually feed their rhetoric. And, you know, it's interesting that some of the evidence that was recovered from the Abbottabad raid against Osama bin Laden suggests that he himself was fretting about the fact that Obama had shifted the lexicon of the war on terrorism away from this Islamic rhetoric, because it was actually making it more difficult for him, Osama bin Laden, to recruit folks. And in fact, he was talking to some of his lieutenants, according to the information we got from Abbottabad, about whether Al-Qaeda needed to rebrand itself. And interestingly enough, the Islamic State figures this out, because, of course, they put Islamic right in their name. And one of the reasons why Obama refuses to call them the Islamic State and instead calls them ISIL, and other folks call them ISIS or Daesh, is to deny them the presumed legitimacy of either being a state or of being one that represents Islam.
Just to tackle that first issue and then turn it over to Stephen, but that's always struck me as such a silly debate, because So ISIL stands for Islamic State of Iraq and Levant. The Levant is a French colonial term referring to what is now Lebanon, parts of Jordan, and Syria. And ISIS stands for Islamic State in Iraq and al-Sham. Sham being basically the Arabic equivalent of ISIL, of Levant, but in the history of the Islamic Caliphate. And so they're basically different words for the exact same thing. I don't think ISIS hears any, or ISIL, we use ISIL at War on the Rocks usually, hears any one of those things and either feels empowered or disempowered. It just strikes me as such a distraction, the debate over the terminology.
So I think there is a degree of distraction.
By the way,
the difference between ISIL and ISIS is stupid. And the only reason, honestly, the only reason that the U.S. government chooses ISIL is because the experts in the intelligence community insist that ISIL is the appropriate translation of the Islamic State's full name. But I think the more important point is that Obama refused, as a matter of principle, to call them the Islamic State. Whether you call them ISIL or ISIS, he would call them by their acronym as opposed to the Islamic State, because in his view, they were pretenders to be a state, and they weren't representing Islam. So he refused to give them the legitimacy of that. One can debate about that, about whether that makes sense or not. But the one thing I can say unequivocally is it never stemmed from a political correctness view. It stemmed from actually a theory of the case that was concerned that in describing any of these groups as Islamic, you played into their rhetoric and this kind of self-fulfilling prophecy of a clash of civilizations. Maybe that's wrong. But that's what Obama believed. But folks on the right here, to include Trump and his acolytes, believe that, you know, we just refuse to call a spade, and these guys are clearly radical Islamic terrorists. But they swing so far to the right on this, in including in that term of radical Islam, everything from Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State on one hand to Iran and Hezbollah on the other hand, to the Muslim Brotherhood on yet another hand, to, frankly, just about any devout Muslim in the United States who represents some fifth column of potential extremists who could blow things up in the United States.
If you're Seb Gorka, yeah. We'll maybe talk about that later. Stephen.
All right. So this is where I you know, let me preface this by saying that I think that there's a lot that needs sort of fixing and adapting with the field of countering violent extremism, you know, starting with the fact that we all need to, you know, get comfortable with the fact that we don't know what leads people to become radicalized. There's an enormous number of risk factors. I always make my students use the term risk factor, not root cause, because cause suggests causality, and there are risk factors that may lead somebody to go in this direction. All of that said, I'm now going to sort of out myself because back in 2006, I worked for a think tank in New York. And according to a master's student at Tufts who's done a sort of a history of the etymology of CVE, stood up the first project titled Countering Violent Extremism. You know, I don't think that I'm...
Congratulations for being the originator of a completely bland and unsuccessful government program.
I don't think in any way I am responsible for that, because it came out of, and this is the point, is that it came out of a lot of conversations with people in the Bush administration at the time, that there were a lot of debates over what language to use for this issue. And these were, I'm not going to sort of go into all the different debates here because they clearly drove me so far out of the field that when I got, you know, to the War Studies Department at King's, I wanted nothing to do with radicalization. And I was like, how can I look at how terrorist groups adapt and evolve? But there were a lot of conversations about, you know, are we trying to combat? Well, you don't combat this. You counter it. Can you prevent it? No, you can't prevent it. Or is it about extremism? No, it's not just extremism. It's got to be violent extremism. Radicalization can have a more positive connotation. I mean, these debates were going on and on and on. And I think there's pros and there's cons to all these different ways that you can approach it. But what you can't avoid is the fact that these conversations were happening during the Bush administration because there was real concern about the fact that Al-Qaeda was able to recruit based on the perception that the United States was at war with Islam. There was just no avoiding that. And so what we wanted to do was we wanted to find terminology that did not play into this idea of a U.S.-led or Western-led war on Islam. Now, you can say that there's a lot that the United States was doing that was feeding into that, and that's fair, but you don't want to reinforce it through your rhetoric.
So there's just a kind of funny anecdote on this. So my recollection is this debate largely happens within the Bush administration in 2006, and that a leading proponent of this is Phil Zelikow, actually, and that they had actually come to some interagency agreement that they would name rename the GWAT, the Global War on Terrorism, as the struggle against violent extremism.
I thought that was a Rumsfeld thing.
Or SAVE.
It?
Well, I think Rumsfeld backed it. But I think there were two issues with this. One, I guess, was the general issue of whether an evangelical president conducting counterterrorism operations against Islamic groups all over the world should be said to be going around the world saving these folks. But I think the more serious concern was that Bush saw the recommendation, which came up from Rumsfeld and others, and basically vetoed it, saying, what are you talking about? I'm at war. And we're at war against terrorists, so we're not going to do this anymore. But it does speak to the fact that this was not just some namby-pamby, you know, left-leaning concern that people like Obama or others around him had, like Brennan, who was his counterterrorism advisor during the campaign and obviously goes on to be his CT advisor in the White House and then director of the CIA. It wasn't just something that they came up and, you know, coming out of left-wing think tanks, but something that folks are debating at the end of the Bush administration.
I do think, yeah, this is not confined to the left, but I think the left, it's mostly on the left in some ways, and it was certainly among some people in the Bush administration too. I'm going to offer three critiques of that kind of thinking, though. First is that there's this amazing Western pretension, both on the left and the right, that for some reason when the President of the United States or Secretary of State is speaking about Islam, he is somehow seen as an authority on Islam. We're assuming that Muslims are taking cues on how to view their own faith from a Western Christian American president, which I think is bizarre. So, and we get all wrapped up over what words we're using for this reason. The second is focusing the war on terror on Al-Qaeda more narrowly, which I do think was smart, but at the same time refusing to use words like jihadist or Islamist, which in the Muslim world are actually uncontroversial terms, might have narrowed our analytical aperture to the point where we missed other jihadist groups like Islamic State rising up. And I honestly forget what my third is because I have had a cold for the last couple of days, but I'm sure it'll come back to me.
So, I mean, from an academic perspective, I mean, I use jihadist all the time. For me, that is the preferred nomenclature for Sunni militant Islamists who, right, think that waging jihad means violent struggle rather than sort of personal struggle and that every Muslim has to do it, right? That's a jihadist, and it's a very sort of useful catch-all phrase. You know, as for your the idea that you know, Muslims around the world are not sort of going to be influenced one way or another by what the president said, I see this very, you know, the conversations that I was privy to, at least back in 2006, are driven in part by what's going on, you know, in the Muslim majority countries, but also by the rising threat of homegrown terrorism in Europe and how European Muslims were sort of viewing themselves within society. And so there, I think there was concern about sort of the way in which Western leaders spoke about this. And the 7/7 bombers, you know, the ringleader, you know, the tape he records where he says, you know, you are at war with us and we are at war with you.
He doesn't cite terminology as evidence for that. He cites the fact that we had invaded Iraq and invaded Afghanistan.
I think what that speaks to is that from a social science perspective, measuring the increment of harm from doing this, I think, is hard. Look, I don't think anybody should be under illusions that if somehow you just call them all violent extremists, you know, it makes the problem go away.
No.
I do think, though, that on the margins, we are capable of giving them propaganda wins by using the wrong terms. And I actually think that we're already seeing that in the month of the Trump administration, where a combination of his extraordinarily expansive and Islamophobic rhetoric, when combined with this crazy ban on refugees and legal migrants coming to the United States from Muslim majority countries, when and also combined with, you know, crazy, you know, spouting off about taking Iraq's oil and whatever, are providing all sorts of opportunities not only for the Islamic State to engage in propaganda, but frankly, it complicates the politics of our partners, who then have to go out and explain, why am I working with a guy who's basically an Islamophobic racist? And, you know, there's all sorts of anecdotal evidence from the front lines of Mosul right now that even the counterterrorism partners we are working with most closely, the counterterrorism services, are deeply disturbed and question the credibility of our partnership because the commander-in-chief is saying crazy shit. And I don't know whether that's a 5% problem or a 10% problem, but it shouldn't be a problem at all. If he just kept his mouth shut or used a different lexicon, it at least wouldn't give these guys an excuse.
Yeah, I mean, I would just add to that that this has always seemed to me one of those issues where you can make the argument that it might not necessarily have a huge benefit to use the terminology that Obama was using. But my counter to that is, there's not a huge cost.
Well, I
said
the cost was if you're putting his analytical
right,
blinders
is
on.
That you're too narrowly scoped. You know, my impression, having talked with a lot of people in the government, is that they are pretty clear about who the enemy is and who they're fighting and what they need to be worried about. So I don't really know that it's too analytically bound.
Commander-in-chief himself dismissed ISIS as the...
The issue is, and I think that's a legitimate criticism.
And that's not a terminology issue.
It's not a terminology issue.
That's not a terminology.
But it might have been shaped by a terminology issue.
It might have been. So here's the thing. I think that is more of an issue of saying that the enemy is al-Qaeda and its affiliates, as opposed to recognizing that there were other Salafist jihadi groups who also had the far enemy in their sights, not just the near enemy. Because constantly through the Obama administration, the question was asked, okay, these groups may or may not share al-Qaeda's ideology, but the question is, do they have the capacity or the intent to threaten the United States? And if we were wrong about their capacity and intent, then we were wrong. But that's not about describing them as radical Islamists or not. So in the case of, you know, ISIS, the Islamic State, Daesh, whatever you want to call them, it wasn't the fact that we didn't recognize that these guys were the offshoots of al-Qaeda in Iraq and, you know, were crazy guys who wanted to do us harm. It was fundamentally a judgment that the president, probably in a miscalculation, that these guys were beaten down. The intelligence community had told him for years to include in the final period of the drawdown in Iraq that these guys were not capable of overthrowing the Iraqi state, that they were down to a few thousand folks who could be managed and overwhelmed by the sheer numbers of Iraqi security forces and others. And so I think when he says they're the JV team, I think he's, you know, basically going on that judgment. Now, that turned out to be an historic miscalculation. I'm not sure what our policy would have been if the judgment had been a little different, but I don't think it's a byproduct of the lexicon.
And if someone wants a really great series on how ISIS reorganized itself in Iraq and was not tracked by most people in doing so, Craig Whiteside a couple of years ago wrote a great series for us on that. Stephen, do you think Trump is doing irreparable harm to our counterterrorism interests through his rhetoric and some of his decisions? Or do you actually think it's not that bad?
I think it's bad. I think it's very bad. I don't know if it's irreparable because we haven't sort of gotten to a point where we can try to repair it yet.
We're only a month in, right?
Well, and you know,
feels like longer, but
it feels like a lot longer. If he's a one-term president and he remains on this path, then we'll see when his successor comes in if it can be repaired. I think one of the things, going back to something that Colin was mentioning earlier, one of the missions that President Obama set for himself when he came into office was to try to repair our relations with the Muslim world, to improve our standing. There were a number of steps taken. You had the speeches. That was also what closing Guantanamo Bay was about, rule of law, but it was also about showing that America was, you know, was going to walk the walk when it came to respect for rule of law and human rights. You know, the complete end to enhanced interrogation techniques, the executive orders that any black sites that were open, you know, not that were any were still open, but that they wouldn't be reopened since they'd been closed. All of that was designed to try to repair our reputation, which was not just a reputation. I mean, our reputation had tangible impact on the kind of partnerships that we could build and on, you know, the degree to which groups were able to recruit. And I think that Donald Trump is turning the clock back, you know, well, but doing it in a way that is worse than what the Bush administration did. I see the Bush administration is doing this in part driven by fear and uncertainty in the wake of the 9/11 attacks. We're 15 years later now. Trump and his team should absolutely 100% know better. And, you know, what's scary to me is that I cannot determine whether this is a perception by the president that it is necessary to sort of talk strong, whether he really believes that groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS pose an existential threat to the United States, or whether he really believes that we are in a war against Islam.
So I think there are basically three discrete risks that emanate from Trump's policies such that we understand them. I think one is that his Islamophobic rhetoric, the ban, talk of going back to torture, although he's also deferring that to Mattis, who probably won't let that happen. Reopening Guantanamo Bay to take detainees. We've gotten it down, you know, the Obama administration got it down to 40-something. But if that population starts to grow, that will reverse the gains, the rhetorical symbolic gains that I think were made during the Obama administration. That's bad because it risks alienating our partners, and in some cases very directly, as in the case of the Iraqis who are caught up in this ban issue, and it creates real problems for Prime Minister Abadi as he's trying to justify his partnership with us and making that partnership last beyond the defeat of Daesh in places like Mosul. So that's problem number one. Problem number two, though, is the general tenor and tone and the policies likely to be pursued by the Trump administration are going to drive a big wedge between us and the Europeans. And it's very difficult to contemplate us having the type of intelligence and law enforcement cooperation necessary to really go after terrorist networks in Western Europe, which pose a threat to our allies and potentially to us, without the kind of tough cooperation. And that's everything from them not having the political space to cooperate with us as closely, to their concerns that, you know, if they provide us intelligence, it might be passed to the Russians, which is not a non-trivial concern that our intelligence, that the intelligence community in Europe has. And the third issue, actually, is that the partners of choice for the Trump administration may themselves conduct activities or drag us into activities that that cause big problems. So the example is, if you lean completely into Sisi and Egypt and the Saudis and the Emiratis, you frame the Muslim Brotherhood as the same as Al-Qaeda, you start to go after and legitimize autocratic states going after groups that are political Islamists but not Salafist jihadists, you could end up radicalizing a new generation of individuals or adding to the sectarian conflict in the region that's fueling a lot of Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State.
So I'd like to close with one conversation on direct action. So we've built this giant global industrial scale targeted killing machine.
The terror industrial complex?
Yeah, that's very successful at reaching out and touching bad guys all over the world. Arguably hasn't had that much a strategic effect, maybe. That's a conversation for another podcast. Colin, what I'd like you to give us insight into is, you know, the Yemen raid that involves Yemeni civilians being killed, a U.S. Service member being killed. Seemed to have been a disaster. The details of that are unclear. You were the vice president's national security advisor. I think your last day of work was the 19th of January, which was the day
before. Yeah, about 9 p.m. on the 19th, yeah.
So you're probably not unfamiliar with the details of what we were doing in Yemen. There's obviously a lot you can't talk about. But maybe what you can talk about is, give us a picture of how the decisions for these raids usually went, the meetings that were involved, the approvals that were involved, versus what you've been able to see with what happened with the Trump administration in this case.
So it's really important. I think, you know, taking one step back, I mentioned a few minutes ago that one of the things that Obama tried to do was to try to rationalize and institutionalize a set of procedures for going after high-value targets. And basically, and most of this, as you know, this stuff has been declassified, but the presidential policy guidance that shaped our counterterrorism operations required the interagency to agree on a number of things, that this was a lawful target, that the individual or group that we were going after was actively planning attacks against the United States, and that we had intelligence that was recent enough to show that. That we had near certainty that the target we were going after was the actual target named, and that we had near certainty that no civilians would be killed in the attack. Whenever the Defense Department would come to the White House to ask for either a variance in those procedures, to opening up the aperture to go after networks as opposed to individuals, for example, or groups instead of individuals, or when they came to us asking for expanded authorities and resources for the United States itself to engage in direct action, not through unmanned aerial systems, but through special operations forces, where there would be a lot more boots on the ground and thus a lot more risk to American lives, and also the perception that we were becoming more deeply enmeshed in a conflict. That was always debated around the table. So there were two issues. One leading up to the Yemen raid. A couple weeks before Christmas, the Pentagon sends over a proposal to the White House to expand the authorities and resources to have U.S. Special Operations Forces accompany coalition partners to conduct direct action raids against AQAP targets in Yemen. They asked for more resources, assets basically, to be deployed to theater to conduct these raids, and authorities for the Secretary of Defense to approve raids against certain targets. What they never did, though, was say, we want to go after this target, this guy, this compound at, you know, at this time of day, and because that would involve them coming in with a specific CONOP, concept of operation, where they would literally put down maps, they would tell us which forces were involved, how they planned to execute, what the contingencies were if things went wrong, and all of the rest. So the deputies discussed this particular request for resources and authorities in the generic context.
The deputies being who specifically?
The deputies being the sub-cabinet level of the national security apparatus. So Deputy Secretary of State, Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, chaired by the Deputy National Security Advisor, Deputy Director of the CIA, Deputy of DNI, Deputy of Treasury. You get the point. We debated this generic set of requests for resources and authorities on January 6th, which is what Sean Spicer, the current press secretary, said. The Pentagon never came to us with a specific raid, whatever compound was hit on January 28th after Trump took office. The deputies basically concluded that AQAP was a huge threat, but that this was represented a significant escalation or ratcheting of our direct involvement in Yemen, and that this was not something that we should jam the incoming administration with, 2 weeks out, if they didn't agree. So the deputies basically recommended to the president that he defer this to the next administration so they could run a deliberate process, their own NSC process. The following week, so that's January 6th, the following 3 or 4 days later in the Oval Office during the PDB, I'm sitting there. Lisa Monaco, who's the president's counterterrorism and homeland security advisor, provides Obama the outbrief from the deputies. And Obama agrees that this is a big piece of business, a major escalation, and therefore this is something that the Trump folks should go through. The challenge then becomes you have inauguration. And a few days after inauguration, Secretary Mattis and Joe Dunford, who's our chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, come to General Flynn, the National Security Advisor, with a proposal to engage in a specific raid against a specific target, one that never came to the Obama administration but was reflective of these general expansion of authorities. And Flynn arranges a dinner between Mattis, Dunford, and the president where they talk about this without any interagency input. There's some reports that suggest that Pompeo was at the dinner, but it was, you know, Kushner was there and Bannon was there, and it was kind of the president's inner circle and the Secretary of Defense and Chairman Dunford, and he approves the raid. And they have a deputies committee meeting the next day that basically is non-consequential because the decision's already been made by the president. And why do I go through all this? Because we would have run the process differently. We would have gone through a deputies and then a principals and then an NSC process where the actual raid was looked at and the intelligence community would double check the Pentagon's homework on, is this a viable target? What are the risks involved, et cetera? The State Department would say, what are the consequences if some tribal folks get killed? Or what are the diplomatic consequences of the raid? The legislative folks would say, who do we need to talk to in Congress to make sure that they're bought in on this? The communications folks would have said, what are our talking points if things go well? What are their talking points if things go well? Don't go so well. the process is built to not only get a good decision, but to protect the president. And Flynn failed in that entire effort. And as a consequence, we went forward with a raid that turned out to be disastrous. A naval SEAL died, and a couple dozen civilians, including some children, were killed. So I think this is an example of how a bad process can cost lives.
And if you want to hear more about how important process is, but in a very, very funny way, and entertaining way, and insightful way, listen to Bombshell, our newest podcast series. Thank you both for joining me. Thanks for listening so much to this episode of the War on the Rocks podcast. Don't forget to check out our written content at waronthrocks.com and, of course, the new War on the Rocks membership at waronthrocks.com/subscribe. Also, later this year, make sure you get Steven's book when it comes out, With Us and Against Us, America's Partners in the War on Terror.